Halloween on the 31st here on the Wrecking Hours. Tune in for that next week. That's it. Once again, here is the Seven Shot Screamers, and we'll take you away into the Monday Talk Forum.
Folks, at WKZK 97.7.7.5. We got a dinger here, hot one in the cold one.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say. For this time,
new ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR at hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum. 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m. Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science, interviews, and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, carbon dioxide from the air turns oceans more acidic, and hope for an HIV vaccine. Here's a scientist soundbite.
The economics are important, and I think that's they're worth saving for that alone. But really, they're just extremely beautiful. I like to call these nature's masterpiece.
You're listening to marine ecologist Joan Kleipas. More with her later. First, science news of the week with Emily Howard and Michael Brennan.
A team of scientists led by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography has made the most precise measurement to date of the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide being absorbed by Earth's global vegetation. The researchers' work appeared in the September 29 issue of the journal Nature. Plants absorb carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, during photosynthesis. After measuring changes in oxygen isotopes within CO2 molecules over a period of about 30 years from 1977 through the present, these scientists found that Earth's vegetation sequesters up to 150 to 175 petagrams of carbon per year. That's in contrast to previous estimates of around 120 petagrams. Either way, it's a lot. If you convert any of those values to kilograms, you get a number with 12 zeros after it.
On October 3rd, the world's most complex ground-based astronomy observatory, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, officially opened to astronomers and also released a first test image. It's a view of the antenna galaxies that cannot be seen at all by visible light or infrared telescopes. Though already in operation, the ALMA telescope, located on the Chanantor Plateau in northern Chile, is not yet complete. Only around a third of the telescope's eventual 66 radio antennas are installed. Working in unison, these antennas, even a partial grouping, can detect much longer wavelengths than those of visible light. This will allow scientists to study extremely cold objects in space, such as the dense clouds of cosmic dust and gas from which stars and planets form, as well as very distant objects in the early universe.
Two tornadoes struck in South Africa on October 2nd during severe local thunderstorms. The first tornado hit a shanty town near Ficksburg in what's known as the Free State, 185 miles south of Johannesburg. One child was killed, more than 40 people were hurt, and over 1,000 homes, many of them shacks, were destroyed. Hours later, a second tornado struck Dedusa, a small town about 40 miles east of Johannesburg. According to weather.com, tornadoes in South Africa are rare. They typically get a tornado about every other year. The tornado season usually starts in November. A video of the October 2nd tornado near Dedusa in South Africa has been widely circulating online. You can see it at earthsky.org.
An international team of astronomers has found the first comet confirmed to contain ocean-like water. The comet is known as Comet Hartley 2. The team reported their results on October 5th in the journal Nature. The team says the water in the comet chemically resembles the makeup of ocean water here on Earth. They found the water using the Herschel Space Observatory. The scientists say their discovery of ocean-like water in Comet Hartley 2 supports the theory that comets could have delivered some of Earth's water. Water is abundant in the universe, but scientists still aren't sure how so much water got here. There are still several theories in the running, but the comet water theory got a boost from this study.
On October 3rd, researchers at the University of California, Davis, announced that they'd successfully transformed a few everyday iPhones into medical-quality imaging devices at a very low cost. The researchers use what are called ball lenses, which are made of finely ground glass. They place the lenses on top of the iPhone camera to make the iPhone work as a microscope. They said the iPhone microscope can, for example, be used to identify different types of blood cells. The researchers said these enhanced iPhones could help doctors and nurses diagnose blood diseases such as anemia in developing nations.
Science interviews up next. We're Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations, including Voice of America.
You've gone too far, Sky.
Child knows
We're at Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Oceans are turning more acidic from carbon dioxide humans release into the air from burning fossil fuels and deforestation. That's according to marine ecologist Joan Kleipas of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Dr. Kleipas has done research on how changes in sea surface temperatures and seawater chemistry have impacted coral reefs. Kleipas was a member of a U.S. National Academy of Sciences committee that produced a 2010 report, Ocean Acidification, a National Strategy to Meet the Challenge of a Changing Ocean. And in 2011, she received a Heinz Award for the Environment. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl interviewed Joan Kleipas.
So what is ocean acidification, and what's the most important thing that people need to know about the phenomena, both in terms of cause and effect?
Ocean acidification is often called the other CO2 problem. So it is caused by the same thing that causes global warming, that is, there's an increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we burn fossil fuels. And because the carbon dioxide concentration is increasing in the atmosphere, more of that carbon dioxide is absorbed by the oceans. And very basically, as the water combines with carbon dioxide, you form carbonic acid. Acid, as you know, lowers the pH of any solution, and so the pH is decreasing. And that has consequences for marine life. So when we think about a lot of marine organisms, things like corals, clams, oysters, things that grow hard shells, those shells are made of calcium carbonate. If you reduce the amount of carbonate in the ocean, then you reduce the ability of those organisms to secrete their shells or their skeletons. And we often refer to it as being similar to osteoporosis. So there's just fewer of the building blocks available to build those hard parts.
You're known for putting ocean acidification on the map, so to speak, with a, I believe it was a 1999 paper in Science. Can you tell us about that? Why was the paper so groundbreaking? And also, what's changed just scientifically in terms of experts' understanding of ocean acidification since then?
In the late 1990s, there was a group of us that were all sort of heading in the same direction on this paper. And we had people looking at paleontology, people looking at the chemistry of the oceans, and people looking at the effects of chemical changes on organisms. And when this group of us got together, we sort of put all of the, you know, we joined all of the dots and realized that some pretty big changes were happening in the oceans. And based on the experimental data we had on organisms, that we were going to see some big responses in a lot of marine organisms. And so we weren't the first people to sort of raise this issue, but I think it was the first time that so many different pieces of evidence were there.
You are especially known for your work on coral reefs. Why are reefs so special and beautiful to you?
I think anyone that has had the privilege to snorkel on a reef or to scuba dive on a reef wouldn't have any trouble understanding why we should protect coral reefs. We're often sort of forced into a corner to talk about their economic value. And yes, they have tremendous economic value. They are the places in the ocean where so many of our fish depend, at least during some part of their life cycle. They provide a lot of food through fishing and through other organisms that grow on the reef for many people and cultures, particularly in third world countries. They have extremely high biodiversity, and we're just discovering now how many of those organisms produce compounds which are important for drugs, such as cancer-fighting drugs and that sort of thing. And, you know, you can go on and on. They also protect coastlines, are protected by coral reefs in many different areas. But I tend to say that, you know, the economics are important, and I think they're worth saving for that alone. But really, they're just extremely beautiful. I like to call these nature's masterpiece. If we lose coral reefs, we're really losing something that nature has taken many, many millions of years to produce. And I don't think many people would say that it's okay to do that.
Is there a danger of reefs going extinct as a consequence of ocean acidification? I mean, if not, what's the level of threat they face, and how do we know?
I'm an optimist at heart, and I don't think that reefs are going to go extinct from ocean acidification. However, that being said, we're witnessing a lot of degradation on our reefs already. We're losing reefs in certain areas. But my optimism comes from the fact that we've only been studying marine life for a few hundred years. I think the more we understand about these marine systems, the more we feel empowered to do something to protect them. I can give you an example of what we're doing in terms of trying to buy time for reefs. So we do a lot of genetic engineering with things like crops. Can we do the same thing with corals and other reef species so that when you grow these corals in a controlled environment, transplant them in the field, that you're building a better reef from the ground up? There's a lot of experimental work going on with that now, and there's some successes, but it does take time to sort of build that up. By trying to determine through modeling studies, through projections of how oceanographic circulation might change, other information like that from satellites, we're trying to determine which areas are most likely to succeed with future climate change, both warming and ocean acidification. So we're working with conservation agencies who are looking to put in things like marine protected areas.
How can you protect a reef against ocean acidification?
We know that algae that grow on the reef, these marine plants that grow side by side with corals on a lot of reefs, they remove CO2 or carbon dioxide from the water column. If you can remove carbon dioxide from the water column, you're doing the reverse of ocean acidification. And we're looking to see if we can do things like putting up farms for algal growth around a reef, which would help pull that carbon dioxide out of the water before it flows over the reef itself.
You've been listening to marine ecologist Joan Kleypas of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
We'll be right back.
We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Join our community for science. You can find us as Earth Sky. Luis Castilla joins us to talk about an experimental vaccine for HIV being developed by scientists in Spain. Luis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jorge. Thank you for having me. So a team of scientists in Spain, led by Mariano Esteban of the National Biotechnology Center, has been testing HIV vaccines with mice and monkeys for a number of years. And when these tests became highly successful, the group decided to begin human trials. The trials included 30 healthy men and women from ages 18 to 55, and they received 3 shots of the vaccines in 2009, with 90% of them developing a defense immune response to the HIV proteins. 1 year later, 85% of these subjects still retained this immune response. A key element of this vaccine is that it only uses 4 proteins from the virus, so the subjects don't develop the disease, but they still develop an immune response.
Right, it's completely safe. Nobody got infected from this experimental trial.
They only had some little side effects like stinging or a little bit of rashness when they got the vaccine. And it's important to mention that this success story is only one of the 3 steps that need to be completed to make this vaccine available to the public.
All right, so what this study seems to show is that this vaccine is eliciting a strong response to people's immune system, you know, people that are healthy. And these scientists are excited about this finding because if this vaccine, this experimental vaccine, can do this for healthy people, it can do this for, it could basically work as like a typical vaccine that people think of for the flu or something. Maybe this vaccine will be developed, as you said, in about a year, and will be able to prevent people from being infected with HIV.
Right now, they're not sure if it can prevent people from getting infected, but it can help the body fight the virus once it's inside the body.
Yeah, I like how the lead scientist, Mariano Esteban, he described how this works in that it works like showing an HIV picture to the immune system's soldiers in one's body, so they'll recognize it, and the immune system will be ready to attack this HIV virus if it appears again in a person's body in the future.
Welcome to virtual reality for immune systems.
This is very hopeful, and this provides a lot of hope for people in the future. Today, the United Nations World Health Organization estimates that more than 33 million people worldwide are infected with HIV.
You know, antiretrovirals are so expensive, you need to take them for the rest of your life. And this vaccine could provide, if not a cure, at least weaning people off these antiretrovirals so they can live with the virus and not stress so much the public health system of their countries.
Thanks, Luis.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Luis Castilla. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.
Earth Sky.
What we do is to explore things that are interesting. So a basic program is to find something that's interesting to us from the point of view of curiosity, understand how it works, see what it's good for, and then in some cases when we're lucky, we might be able to spin out at the end something that would be a small business, a startup that would start transferring the benefits of knowledge into a society in terms of solutions to problems.
You are listening to chemist George Whitesides of Harvard, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Whitesides is the most influential chemist alive today, with more scientific citations in published work than anyone. He's co-founded a dozen companies worth over $20 billion. And behind his work, he says, is a desire to create simple solutions for difficult common problems, such as low-cost health diagnostics for developing countries like Rwanda. George Whitesides talked more about what it means to be a chemist today with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Whitesides, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
I'm very happy to be here.
What inspired you to study chemistry, and what was the science community like as a young scientist in the 50s and 60s?
Chemistry is a really terrifically interesting area because it's about the world that we can see and feel. So if you're curious, you want to know why leaves are green and why things are alive and why the paint on walls is white or red, and that's what chemistry does. So the original motivation was just that it was great fun to think about how the world worked. And in the 50s and 60s, when I started in that glacial time, chemistry had a pretty restricted view of what it did. That is, it made molecules, which are very small collections of atoms. And molecules are what makes up air and drugs and the molecules that go into polymers and paint and gasoline and all of that kind of thing. But really the purpose of chemistry was to make molecules. It's gotten to be a lot more expansive. It's now very interested very broadly in the question of what is life, and very interested very broadly in the question of what are materials and then other things as well. But it's a wonderful area because it brings you into contact with almost anything that you see and feel and taste and smell and talk to.
Would you tell us a little bit about some research that you're doing on something that you've described as soft robots? What's going on there?
Robots are really, really interesting as a subject and as a kind of technology. The core problem with robotics is that there are circumstances in which doing a job can be too dangerous for a person. It could be impractical for a person to be in that circumstance. The problem that needs to be done can be too complicated. An example is using robots to lift heavy panels in place and welding the body parts of an automobile. So most of the robots that you see have been developed either as part of manufacturing or sometimes for applications, let's say in the military, where you would like to not have people defusing a explosive device. You would like to have a machine doing the defusing. Now, most of these robots are either made to look a little bit like animals or people. That is to say, they are so-called hard robots. They have a skeleton and they have motors that run things that might be arms and legs, or sometimes they have treads, but the treads are fused then to something that looks like an arm. But if you think about the world around you, it's full of creatures that are butterflies and worms and octopi and starfish. And these are all creatures that don't have a hard internal skeleton. They have some different structure that holds them together. So we're very interested in putting together robots that are soft and look less like a dog and more like a starfish. And, of course, the connection to chemistry in that is that these creatures are not made out of these machines, are not made out of metal and springs. They're basically made out of rubber and elastomers and things like that, as is the original creature. So the trick here is to find ways of putting together the material science of elastomers in such a fashion that when properly actuated, you can get behaviors crawling and jumping and moving through holes that begin to look like these soft things that we live with in the world. And we believe there'll be a whole range of applications in these from, to take two examples, surgery, to going through small holes in a collapsed building, which might be a disaster relief after an earthquake or something of that sort.
You've spoken on where the innovation, these meaningful changes, and the jobs in chemistry will come from.
in the years ahead in the United States. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
We now find ourselves in some economic difficulty with fewer jobs in the country. And the question is it because there are fewer needs? And if you think about it, that can't possibly be right, because we know we have this major problem of providing health care, albeit at lower cost. So how do we provide health care at lower cost? How do we manage carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And how do we think about global stewardship? How do we use fuel more efficiently? I mean, all of these kinds of questions are critically important. How do we provide water for the world? And most of them are chemical jobs. So we're in this, to me, odd situation that we have an enormous range of talent in the field of chemistry and science in general that is in principle poised to solve problems. And we have the problems that need to be solved because they're everywhere. And why is it we don't have jobs? And that's a very complicated question, and the answers are very complicated. But basically, a short-form answer is that the United States right now tends to emphasize the solution of problems that can be solved very quickly. And the solution to complicated scientific problems often takes a rather long period of time. So in my view, and many people's view, one of the things we want to think about is how do we encourage more innovation and the creation of more new jobs in the United States? So we've been working, we and many other people in the United States are working on trying to find ways of coupling more effectively people who want jobs, problems that need to be solved, and jobs that need to be created through innovation. And it's something the United States still does better than any other country. We just need to put it back on track now.
You've been listening to George Whitesides, the Flowers University Professor of Chemistry at Harvard University. This Earth Sky podcast is part of the Thanks to Chemistry series, produced in cooperation with the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Generous sponsorship support was provided by the BASF Corporation. Additional production support was provided by the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation, DuPont, and ExxonMobil. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Richard Bell, co-author of a book called Nuke Speak. We'll also speak with Avital Binstock from Sierra Magazine to get some tips for greening your office. And Chris Costello talks with us about the problem of red tide in Florida and what people can do about it. We're here now with Richard Bell, who is one of the co-authors of a book called Nuke Speak, which will be released as an ebook by Sierra Club Books on October 4th. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the title of the book. What is Nuke Speak? What does that mean? And can you cite some examples?
Well, the title it's an homage to George Orwell. In his book, 1984, the official state language was called Newspeak. So we coined Nukespeak to talk about the language that people use for promoting the spread of nuclear power plants and for minimizing the dangers of nuclear weapons. Here's some examples. When there's an accident at a nuclear reactor, the company talks about it in terms of an incident or an event, not an accident. There was a recent accident at a French nuclear waste processing plant that killed at least one worker and injured several more. But the French officials who are handling the accident say that it was not a nuclear accident, it was an industrial accident. Mm-hmm. So changing the terminology is part of what happens with Nukespeak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan had a famous example. We had developed something called the MX missile, which in fact would significantly increase the danger of a nuclear war. And Reagan had the missile renamed the Peacekeeper missile, which was as far from what it was designed to do as it could possibly be.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of this book. It was first written, I think, almost 30 years ago, and this is an updated version of the book. What's the most surprising thing that you learned in updating the book for this new e-publication?
Well, first I would have thought that the danger of nuclear war had gone down a bit since the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. But in fact, both countries, the U.S. and Russia, are still keeping thousands of nuclear weapons ready to go on a 15-minute warning. So that was quite distressing. I also was surprised to find that Mikhail Gorbachev said in 2006, on the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear reactor disaster, that the meltdown at that reactor actually, in his opinion, contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union 5 years later, and that people were so upset about the way in which the Soviet Union's government misled people about the scope of that accident that it undercut the government's credibility that badly.
You've said that there's no difference between atoms for war and atoms for peace, that the atoms don't know the difference. Can you elaborate on this?
Sure. If you have a peaceful, and the word peaceful here is what we would call a nuke-speak word, a peaceful nuclear power program, your scientists and your engineers are learning all they need to know about nuclear physics in order to be able to build bombs. They're getting the equipment, they're getting some of the raw materials that they need, and then it just becomes a question of whether they want to build bombs or not.
Mm-hmm.
For example, India used a Canadian research reactor that was partially funded by the United States under the Atoms for Peace program, and they used that reactor to make the plutonium that they used in their first nuclear weapon.
What do you think the nuclear industry learned from the earlier accidents at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl?
Well, there's some very specific things that they learned. One that would be familiar to people who like to watch the reactor operating room in The Simpsons is that they now require every utility to build a practice control room that looks exactly like the real one. At Three Mile Island, one of the things that happened was that the workers hadn't been properly trained, and so when all these alarms and things started going off, they really didn't know what to do. So that's one of the big changes. And then there are lots of smaller changes in trying to upgrade the quality of the plants, and they also have insisted on having much better emergency planning for trying to notify people around the plant about what was happening. Chernobyl was a really different kind of accident. The Chernobyl plant did not have a concrete containment vessel around it, so that would be a lesson that was learned, that you shouldn't build nuclear reactors without containment vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And then the engineers at the Chernobyl plant were, in a sense, conducting an experiment that went out of control. And another lesson that was learned there would be you shouldn't run experiments with reactors while they're online.
Speaking about accidents, let's talk about what happened at Fukushima. Do you feel like after what happened there, have the plans and aspirations for a quote-unquote nuclear renaissance here in the United States been altered? And is the nuclear power industry still trying to sell itself as like a clean, green solution to global warming?
Well, first of all, the trick here is who's paying for building these nuclear plants.
Mm-hmm.
There are 66 nuclear plants under construction all over around the world, and not a single one of those plants is being paid for with money from the so-called free market. Every single one of the plants that's under construction is a government project. So what we really got today is nuclear socialism for building these plants.
You mean because they're so expensive that they're not competitive?
Right. On the one hand, we say we should be trusting the markets to make decisions and that investors know best. And investors have already voted with their money all around the world about nuclear power, and they won't put their money into these plants. So only governments are big enough and, in a sense, dumb enough to ignore the marketplace and, for reasons of prestige or wanting to get the raw materials to create a bomb program, countries are still willing to put this money up, even though it's a losing investment as far as the marketplace is concerned. As far as nuclear renaissance goes, It's definitely a big setback, but since none of the plants that are under construction are subject to very direct democratic control, it's hard for people to have a public to have an impact. And what you do see is that in countries like Germany, Italy, Switzerland, and Japan, where they're, especially Japan, the governments are now officially backing away from their nuclear programs. So there are definitely places where there would have been more nuclear plants before Fukushima that are not going to happen, primarily because of public pressure.
Anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
Well, I think that we should definitely be concerned, as far as Fukushima goes, that there are 21 General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors in the United States that are the same design that failed in Fukushima. And there's an environmental group, Beyond Nuclear, that has formally petitioned the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to suspend the licenses for these plants until we can guarantee that they can't suffer the kinds of consequences that happened at Fukushima.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Richard Bell. He's one of the co-authors of a book called Nuke Speak, first released almost 30 years ago and now in a new updated e-book version coming out from Sierra Club Books October 4th. We're here now in the studio with Avital Binstock, who's the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Hi, Orly.
Today we're going to talk about some tips for ways to green your workplace.
Yes.
So let's start just by jumping in and tell us some of the things that you think are the best tips to keep in mind if you want to go green at work.
Sure. So I guess when I first started thinking about this, I started thinking about lighting. I found out that artificial lighting accounts for almost half of the electricity use in office buildings, which is huge if you consider how many office buildings there are and how much electricity is being used, how much coal is being burned for it probably. So you want to make sure that the lights are turned off whenever no one is in a room. So that means when you leave at night, when you leave a conference room, when you leave the mail room, any room that you go into, make sure the lights are turned off whenever you're leaving and no one else is in there. If you're not in a really hot climate, you'll want to invite in natural light wherever possible. Open the windows if you can, if you have one. Let in that natural light instead of using artificial lighting. Now, this is null if you're going to, if it's going to make you need to use more heat, then you might want to keep the blinds down and use the artificial light. But if you're not in a hot climate, that's a good option. And you want to also be using Energy Star rated light bulbs and fixtures. And sometimes that's more on the management aspect of things. So if you're a manager, you can do that. If you're an employee, you can ask your manager to do that. Because those use 2/3 less energy than regular lighting. So that's a really big reduction that you can achieve with that. And you can also install timers or motion sensors that automatically shut off lights when they're not needed. And again, that's something that your manager might need to do if you're not the person in charge of that.
And we have those at the Sierra Club office. They work very well.
Yeah, they do.
What about computers?
Yeah, so this is a big one. A lot of people don't turn off their computer before they go home at night and consider this a slap on the wrist for computers are huge when it comes to consuming energy. They have a lot going on inside. They have a fan that's running. If you just keep it running all night, it's gonna use all that electricity for no reason.
Now, I think there are some myths around the computer, so let's dispel those myths once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
Screensavers, good or bad?
Bad.
They don't save
they
energy.
They do not save energy. No, it's just more lights on your screen. Unless you put your computer to sleep and your screen is dark. Screensavers are still using your screen for generating.
But putting the computer to sleep during short breaks can cut energy, right?
Exactly, yeah. So during the day, if you're walking away for lunch, put your computer on a setting where it'll fall asleep after, you know, whatever you're comfortable with, 1 minute, 5 minutes. But you don't have to shut down your whole computer if you're going to lunch, but you can put it in sleep mode, and that will save energy. That'll actually cut energy use up to 70%.
Oh, that's good. And then people, I think, sometimes think that turning the computer off and on frequently is bad for the computer, but it's really not, right?
I don't think it is. I think the startup the startup energy you use when starting a computer, and this is actually the same for cars, is I think the rule for cars is if you're idling 15 seconds, 15 seconds or more, turn it off. And mm-hmm. I think people think that the startup energy for computers and other things is more than it actually is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, mm-hmm. if you're away for a couple hours, just turn it off.
Okay, now we can't talk about going green at work without talking about printing. And paper, because
yes.
people use a lot of paper. What yes. are your tips around that?
Well, I read a staggering number. This is way beyond what I'd even thought, but the average U.S. office worker can go through up to 10,000 sheets of copy paper per year,
wow.
which is like, if you imagine 10,000 pieces of paper, that's a lot. And if you imagine how many U.S. office workers there are, that's a lot. So there are things that you can do to prevent all this paper waste, which, if you look at a piece of paper, think of a tree, because that's what it is. That's where it came from. So print double-sided. That's the first thing. That's immediately going to cut your paper use 50% at least. And if you have a bunch of papers that you haven't already printed double-sided on, use the backsides for faxes or scrap paper drafts. Just use the backsides of printed paper. Avoid color printing if at all possible. That creates more waste. And this is kind of fun. There's an eco font
really?
That you can download. Yeah, if you just Google eco font, it'll come right up. And if you kind of magnify the font, you'll see that there are actually little holes, little empty space huh. where there isn't ink. So it actually uses a lot less ink. It doesn't make a difference when you look at the font just, with your naked eye, but it actually uses less ink.
Is it a font that people already use? Is it like an eco version of Times New Roman, or
yeah.
it's a completely different?
Yeah. No, okay. it'll look, no one will look at your paper weird. It'll look like a normal font, but it's kind of embedded secret is that there are little holes in it where ink isn't.
Eco font. This might be the most surprising tip we get today.
Yeah, it's fun. You can Google it. It'll come right up. And you can just download it and use it, and you'll be using a lot less ink, which will save you money. And
well, it saves money too. The printer cartridges are really expensive.
Oh yeah, yeah. And speaking of ink cartridges, you'll want to recycle the toner and the ink cartridges, and buy, if you're in charge of buying them, buy remanufactured ones. Office Depot put out, which actually Office Depot runs a decent recycling program, they say that each remanufactured toner cartridge keeps approximately 2.5 pounds of metal and plastic out of landfills. So that's 2.5 pounds for each recycled toner cartridge.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's significant.
Well, that is about all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital Binshtok, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine.
Thanks, Orly.
Joining us now from Florida is Chris Costello, who's the lead organizer for the Sierra Club's Red Tide campaign in Florida. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Orly.
So, Chris, you're heading the Sierra Club's work in Florida to get cities and towns to implement what you might call a fertilizer ban during the summer months. And I think this is an unusual campaign that a lot of people don't know about. So can you tell us a little bit more about what is the problem with fertilizer? What kind of damage does it cause?
Sure. Well, it really goes back to a big moment in Florida history. In 2005, following a number of hurricanes and tropical storms, the state was hit by massive harmful algal blooms. Red tide lasted a year or more along the southwest Gulf Coast.
And what is that? What is an algal bloom? I mean, what is red tide for our listeners in other parts of the country?
Sure. Red tide is a type of algal bloom. Algae, different kinds of algae, whether they're potentially toxic or not, live and exist in water bodies, whether they're freshwater or marine. When they are overfed, in this case by anthropogenic sources or man-made, human-made, human contributions to nutrient pollution, that is, that which feeds all life and certainly all plant life, nitrogen and phosphorus, when there is too much, the algae blooms or there are outbreaks. It grows too much, and it grows so much that it can overtake water bodies, decrease the dissolved oxygen. Oxygen starve all of the marine life in those water bodies and destroy not only the habitat and the wildlife, but also create very substantial and dangerous human impacts. Many of these algae are toxic to humans. So the overgrowth of toxic algae is a very big problem.
So for people who love the beaches in Florida, if I'm understanding this right, part of the problem is that when people use fertilizers and then those wash away and get into the waterway, the fertilizers actually cause these algae to grow in the water. And so it can have effects that people are not intending in terms of, you know, making the water potentially toxic for swimming.
Absolutely. Any introduction of excess nitrogen and phosphorus will help feed those nuisance or harmful algae. Urban fertilizer is one source of that excess nitrogen and phosphorus. And in fact, for local government, it is the least costly method of reducing the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and phosphorus that gets into the water body. Other possibilities are reducing agricultural inputs, reducing wastewater treatment inputs, all of which cost much more money and much more infrastructure. Reducing the amount of urban fertilizer or residential fertilizer, the stuff we put on our back and front yard, is the lowest hanging fruit, but can make substantial dent in the overall nutrient load that goes into water bodies.
So for Florida residents who love the beaches and might not have known that the fertilizer they're putting on their lawns, you know, is causing this toxic red tide, what are some of the other alternatives besides putting these fertilizers on their lawns?
Well, the campaign that has was really started in 2005 and has progressed and been very successful over the past almost 7 years, is to wisely manage the fertilizer that people put on their yard. And so the question is, when is the best time to put fertilizer? What is the best amount of fertilizer to put, a sustainable amount, and when, how much, and what kind of fertilizer you put down. And so these ordinances, these local government ordinances to reduce the excessive inputs of these nutrients have come together and grown along the Southwest Gulf Coast to an enormous amount. So the question for folks that have a backyard is, in Florida, when not to put on fertilizer. And when not to put on fertilizer in Florida is during the rainy season. Most of Florida gets 60% or more of their rainfall in just 4 months of the year. And that is most of the hurricane season and all of the summer, from June 1st to the end of September. That is when it doesn't matter who puts down the fertilizer, whether it's a commercial applicator or just a do-it-yourselfer. If you put it down, it's most likely going to wash off, costing you money, wasting your money, and really damaging and adding to the problem of our polluted water bodies.
Let's talk about the money savings there. I know that recently Tampa became the latest city to implement a ban, which is expected to prevent about 8 tons of nitrogen from getting into Tampa's waterways. And I heard that it would save the city an estimated somewhere around $50, $56 million. But where is that savings coming from? Is it because it's so expensive to treat these toxic algae, red tide blooms when they happen?
Well, it comes from a number of different ways. Number one, a wastewater treatment and the wastewater discharge adds a lot of nutrients to Tampa Bay. If you reduce the amount of urban fertilizer nutrient pollution, that makes it less important or less necessary to invest in additional infrastructure to reduce the amount of wastewater treatment. And so it is much cheaper to prevent the urban fertilizer inputs than to pay for infrastructure improvements at the wastewater treatment level. So that is one example. The other is cleanup projects. Stormwater projects, detention and retention projects that keep the water out of flowing or larger water bodies in order to treat it first are very expensive. Those are also infrastructure projects that cost hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. Pound per pound, reducing the amount of fertilizer input saves a lot of money, millions of dollars per year on those kinds of projects.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today. Anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
Well, I would just say that the reason that so many communities in Florida have taken this step, we're now at close to 50 local governments that have put strict controls on urban fertilizer use, The only way they got that got done is by citizens joining together to promote sustainable landscaping at the local level. And so I encourage anyone out there who's listening who wants more information on how to get that done to contact me.
And how can our listeners find out more or get in touch?
You can go to the Sierra Club website and search for the Florida chapter, and that will get them there.
Well, thanks so much. You've been listening to Chris Costello, who's heading the Sierra Club's work in Florida to get cities and towns to implement fertilizer bans during the summer months in order to protect local waterways from the toxic runoff. Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is pumpkin season, and I know there's lots of pumpkins out there. So let's take a second to talk about some of your recipe ideas for what people can do with pumpkin. I think the first thing, of course, is to point out that you shouldn't be cooking up your jack-o'-lantern, right? Those are different pumpkins than the cooking pumpkins we're talking about.
That's correct. You want to use what we call sugar pumpkins or sugar pie pumpkins. And if you happen to have a sugar pumpkin and you're not using it for dessert and you'd like to make a soup with it, here's a simple soup that you can make. I think roasting it is great. You just cut it in half, scoop out the seeds, trim off that big stem if it's on there.
You can roast separately.
Seeds you
right?
can roast separately if you'd like. And the other thing you can do is, if you want, you can save the seeds and the scooped innards from the pumpkin, and you can make a stock with that if you'd like to. So you can have that cooking while you go ahead and roast your squash. And roast your squash, put it with a cavity side down on a baking sheet, and if you want it to cook quickly, just cover it with aluminum foil or put it in a deep dish that has a lid, like a Dutch oven, and roast that at 400 degrees until it is nice and tender and caving in on itself. Scoop it out, set it aside, and then I'll say, as we say in recipes, meanwhile, saute up some onions or some leeks, add a little garlic when they're nice, and saute those in with a little olive oil, salt and pepper. When they are nice and tender, if you'd like, you can add a little bit of white wine. Cook that down a little bit. Take your pumpkin, add a little bit of stock to that, get it all cooking along, add a little more salt and pepper, and then just run it through a food mill, or if you want to puree it in a food processor or in a blender. And then if you'd like, you can finish that with a little bit of cream or not, just depending. A lot of times the dairy isn't necessary.
Any other spices that you recommend to pair with pumpkin?
Let's see. Sometimes we will add, not necessarily spices for a soup, but we'll make a little apple compote on the side. So we cook up peel apples, peel and core them, just cook those up with a tiny bit of apple juice, let it remain chunky, and then just stir that into the soup. It's delicious.
Sounds great. You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Bill in University Place, Washington asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, what is the correct temperature for my refrigerator and freezer? I want to make sure I'm not wasting energy."
Well, Phil, the best thing to do is to set the fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and the freezer at zero. And because it takes more energy to keep a freezer cold if it's empty, make sure to keep it filled. If necessary, you can use jugs of water or ice. Standing there with the door open, pondering what to eat, is an indisputable juice drain, so keep that door closed. If you want to get even better energy savings, visit EnergyStar.gov to find Energy Star appliances. These are more efficient models that will save energy and save you money on your bills. So remember, set that fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and set the freezer at zero. And for the best energy savings, look for an efficient Energy Star model.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at SierraClubRadio.org. This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at SierraClubRadio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit SierraClubRadio.com.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say. for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and it is time for Just a Little Indie. And the, today is going to be a special Just a Little Indie because we have visitors. Yay for visitors. I'm always happy when new people are here. Well, not necessarily new people, because Greenberg's been here before many times.
Is my mic? Yes, it is.
It is.
I am far from new, but I feel about as bright and shiny as a new dime right now.
Yay!
There's just something special about coming back here. It just recalibrates everything, and I'm just pleased as punch and just honored that you would carve out a little drawer for me in your little little chest of drawers of radio.
Oh, anytime. Anytime. for some of you out there, you might not know Greenberg, because it's been a few years since he's been on this airwaves, but he has been a staple on some other stations and other locations and stuff of that nature. But he was on WHFR for many years. How many years were you here?
I was here from 2003 until 2004, and then I went to Wisconsin, a dark period of my life I like to call my exile behind the cheddar curtain. And there was a really nice college station out there that let me have some airtime. And I didn't stay in Wisconsin very long. And when I came back here in the fall of 2004, you guys just very kindly and warmly welcomed me back. And I was here until, I would say, the spring of 2006. So yeah, roughly about 3 years or
that's
so.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. It was a few years, you know.
And
nothing to laugh at.
Not at all. Unless you caught me on one of those days where I was just like sounding like a Porky Pig, which yeah. I've had a few of those days.
I think we all have. Yeah. Anyway.